I'm deeply touched. What a wonderful and unexpected moment. It's a pleasure to be here tonight. I won't keep you long, but I would like to tell you some stories and to read some of the things that I have written. First, let me say that I feel a little bit disadvantaged tonight. First of all, I was made to wear a tie at dinner. Then I had to compete against the presidential debate. And then, to add insult to injury, I was made to follow upon that wonderful act that preceded me. I live in Arizona. I have not lived there long, though I grew up in the Southwest. I live now in the south of Arizona, on the apron of the Sonoran Desert. And I want to tell you that people who live in Tucson and in Phoenix and in that general area spend a lot of time in swimming pools. Swimming is the chief form of exercise for me. I don't know how many of you might be swimmers. I suspect that some of you are joggers. But swimming and jogging are surely two of the most damnably boring things ever devised by man. But I have found a way to combat that boredom as I swim laps. I compose epitaphs. I have 2-lap epitaphs, 4-lap epitaphs, 10-lap epitaphs. I want to read you a couple of them. And I want you to understand that these were composed without benefit of pad and pencil, and while I was completely wet. This one is called Planned Parenthood. If coupling should but make us whole, and of the self same mind and soul, then couplelets in celebration, we have contained the population. 4-lapper. This one is called The Minor Writer. Certainly it was suicide. He read himself until he died. Okay. 2-lapper. This one doesn't have a title. He drove himself and was undone and left no stone unturned but one. That's really an epigram, isn't it? My favorite, just one more. My favorite is on chastity. Here lies a lady sweet and chaste. Here lies the matter. Chaste makes waste. Okay? Now, if I may make an abrupt switch, turn, I want to read some charms that Carter mentioned in the introduction. These are very serious to me. Not too long ago, several years now, I ran across some crow charms. And these are wonderful verbal equations which are designed to bring about some sort of magical change in the world. The crow charms that I remember especially well are recited by a warrior who wants to disarm his enemy. And so he does so by a kind of hypnotism. He says something like this: when we hear the rustling of the leaves, and when we see the blue light of the full moon up on the prairie, we grow sleepy, don't we? I have an idea that those are very powerful things, and one mustn't play with them, one mustn't recite them too often. Well, with that much of a preface, let me read some of the charms that I've written. The first is designed perhaps to ensure the healthy growth of a child. My child, can you reach those berries, the red and blue and purple berries? They are delicious, perhaps. Here's the second. There are four altogether. The bear is coming. There are bones all about. There are pitiful cries. There are knives for mourning. The bear is coming. Someone very old has said so. Number three. At the very sight of my horse, at the very sight of my trappings, at the very sight of my shield, you are afraid, aren't you? Number four. The wind is cold, isn't it? The moon is dark, isn't it? The plain is wide, isn't it? Death dances at the base of that hill. So, here's a very recent one. I had a student last year who was a Chippewa woman, and she knew a great deal about bears. I guess she had grown up in country where there are a good many black bears. And she told me about having seen a bear which had been killed, and someone, to her great distress, had cut off the paws of the bear simply in order to take the claws. And that made a great impression on me when I heard that, and I wrote. She also gave me this information, which I suspect is true. Bears love the taste of whiskey. And she says that ceremonially, she goes out and pours whiskey into the snow for the bears. Anyway, this poem, a very recent one, as I say, is called Scaffold Bear. Here in this cave of sleep, I know of an animal on the slope. It rambles like the rain. Its bones are already yellow, probably. It is huge and without age. No one has seen it, but there are stories. Juan Reyes dreamed of it too. It reared against a moonlit cloud and sundered the dream. A young girl spoke of it with wonder, having heard it scoop the river for its food. My own story is this. A good man killed himself. The next morning, a bear, stripped of its skin, lay on a scaffold in a range of trees, bleeding, breathing faintly. Its great paws had been removed. The bear spoke to someone there, perhaps to me, for in this cave of sleep, I am at home to bears. I want to continue by telling you a story. In order to understand the story, though, I need to give you a little information. According to their origin myth, the Kiowas entered the world through a hollow log. Several hundred years ago, they migrated from the Yellowstone country to the southern plains. For a time, they lived in the Black Hills. On November 13, 1833, there was a brilliant shower of Leonid meteors, especially visible over North America. The night sky was filled with falling stars. That event is of very great importance to the people on the plains, and it is recorded in the Kiowa calendars. Kosan is the name of an old woman I once met in Oklahoma. We spent one afternoon together, and she told me wonderful stories. She was, she reckoned, 100 years old. The sun dance was the chief religious ceremony of the Kiowas, as it was for the other Plains tribes. It was held once each year at a time and place designated by the keeper of the Sundance fetish, which in Kiowa is called Taimei. On that occasion, the occasion of the Sundance, all the bands of the tribe converged upon the Sundance place. It was the only time they came together, and they came together in belief, in love, in devotion, in celebration. Palo Duro Canyon was the last buffalo range on the southern plains. There the Kiowas sought refuge in 1873. But the cavalry bore down upon them and caused them to panic. They fled, leaving their stores to be pillaged. That was the end of their golden age. And now the story that I want to tell you. I wrote a book once called The Way to Rainy Mountain, which is essentially a collection of Kiowa folk tales to which I have added commentaries. One night, a strange thing happened. I had written the greater part of The Way to Rainy Mountain, all of it, in fact, except the epilogue. I had set down the last of the old Kiowa tales, and I had composed both the historical and the autobiographical commentaries for it. I had the sense of being out of breath, of having said what it was in me to say on that subject. The manuscript lay before me in the bright light, small, to be sure, but complete, or nearly so. I had written the two poems in which that book is framed. I had uttered the last word, as it were, and yet something was missing. A whole piece was missing. And I began once again to write. This is what I wrote. During the first hours after midnight, on the morning of November 13, 1833, it seemed that the world was coming to an end. Suddenly, the stillness of the night was broken. There were brilliant flashes of light in the sky, light of such intensity that people were awakened by it. With the speed and density of a driving rain, stars were falling in the universe. Some were brighter than Venus. One, according to the New York Times, was as large as the moon. I went on to say that that event, the falling of the stars over the Earth, that explosion of Leonid meteors, which occurred more than 150 years ago now, is among the earliest entries in the Kiowa calendars. So deeply impressed upon the imagination of the Kiowas is that old phenomenon that it is remembered still. It has come to be a part of the racial memory, the blood memory. The living memory, I wrote, and the verbal tradition which transcends it were brought together for me once and for all in the person of Kosan. It seemed eminently right for me to deal, after all, with that old woman. She is among the most venerable people I have ever known. She spoke and sang to me one summer afternoon in Oklahoma. It was like a dream. When I was born, she was already old. She was a grown woman when my grandparents came into the world. She sat perfectly still, folded over upon herself, and it did not seem possible to me that so many years, a century, could be so compacted and distilled. Her songs were sad. Her voice shuddered, but it did not fail. There was an old whimsy, too, a delight in language and in remembrance, and that delight shone in her one eye. She had only one eye. She imagined, she conjured up the past, imagining perfectly the long continuity of her being. She remembered the child, the young girl, wild and vital she had been. She remembered the Sundance. The last Kiowa Sundance was held in 1887. She had been there. She had seen it. And I asked her to tell me a little about it. This is what she said. She said, there was an old, old woman. She had something on her back, this old woman. The boys of the Rabbit Society went out to see what it was that she had on her back. The old woman had a bag full of earth on her back. It was a certain kind of sandy earth. That is what they must have in the lodge. The dancers must dance upon the sandy earth. The old woman held a digging tool in her hand. She turned towards the south and pointed with her lips. It was like a kiss. And she began to sing. Now we have brought the earth. Now it is time to play. As old as I am, I still have the feeling of play. That, said Kosan, was the beginning of the Sundance. That is how it always began. Well, by this time, I was back into the book, caught up completely in the act of writing. I had projected myself, imagined myself out of the room and out of time. I was there with Kosan in the Oklahoma July. We laughed easily together. I felt that I had known her all my life, and indeed all of hers. I did not want to let go of her, but I had come to the end. And I sat down, almost grudgingly, the final sentences. It was, I wrote, all of this and more a quest, a going forth upon the way to Rainy Mountain. Probably, Kosan, too, is dead now. At times, in the quiet of evening, I think she must have wondered, dreaming, who she was. Was she become in her sleep that old purveyor of the sacred earth, perhaps, that ancient one who, old as she was, still had the feeling of play? And in her mind, at times, did she see the falling stars? For some time, I sat looking down at these words on the page, trying to deal with the emptiness that had come about inside of me. The words did not seem real. The longer I looked at them, the more unfamiliar they became. At last I could scarcely believe that they made sense, that they had anything whatsoever to do with meaning. In a kind of nervous anxiety, I went back over the final paragraphs, backwards and forwards, hurriedly, and my eyes fell upon the name Kosan. And all at once, everything seemed suddenly to refer to that name. The name seemed to humanize the whole complexity of language. All at once, absolutely, I had the sense of the magic of words and of names. Then it was that that ancient one-eyed woman, Kosan, stepped out of the language and stood before me on the page. I was amazed, of course, and yet it seemed to me entirely appropriate that this should happen. "Yes, grandson," she said, "what is it? What do you want? I was just now writing about you, I replied, stammering. No, she replied, and she cackled, I thought. She went on. You have imagined me well, grandson, and so I am. You have imagined that I dream, and so I do. I have seen the falling stars. But all of this imagining, I protested, is taking place in my mind. You, grandmother, you're not actually here. You're not really here in this room. It occurred to me that I was being extremely rude, but I couldn't help myself anyway. She seemed to understand. Be careful of your pronouncements, grandson, she said. You imagine that I am here in this room, do you not? That is worth something. You see, I have existence, whole being in your imagination. Oh, it is but one kind of being, to be sure, but it is perhaps the best of all kinds. If I am not here in this room, grandson, surely neither are you. I think I see what you mean, I said meekly. I felt justly rebuked. Tell me, grandmother, how old are you? Oh, I do not know, she replied. You know, the Kiowas came into the world through a hollow log. In my mind's eye, I have seen them emerge one by one from the mouth of that log. I've seen them so clearly, how they were dressed, how delighted they were to see the world around them. I must have been there. I must have taken part in that old migration of the Kiowas from the Yellowstone to the southern plains, for I have seen antelope bounding in the tall grass near the Bighorn River. I've seen the ghost forests of the Black Hills. Once, grandson, I saw the red cliffs of Palo Duro Canyon. I was with those who were camped in the Wichita Mountains when the stars fell. You are indeed very old, I said. And you have seen many things. Yes, I imagine that I have, she said. And then she turned slowly around. She nodded once, and she receded into the language I had made. And then I imagined that I was in the room alone. So that's the story. Oh, yeah, I tell you another story, short one. There are, I think, 24 tales in The Way to Rainy Mountain. One of them is about a man who is saved by a dog. And it begins, this happened a long time ago when dogs could talk. And the story is very simple. It's about a man who had been thrown away, as the story has it. I take it that means he was no longer of use to the tribe, and so he had been abandoned. Or he had taken it upon himself to wander off alone. A dog came up to him and said, "You are in great danger. There are enemies all around. You're surrounded, and your peril is very great." And the man, of course, was alarmed, and he said to the dog, "What must I do? What must I do?" And the dog said, "I could save you." And the man says, "Oh, yes, please do. Please do." And the dog said, "Well, you know dogs." The dog said, "Wait a minute. Hold it. You know, I have puppies. They are very young. They are cold. They are hungry. If you will take care of my puppies, I will save you. So the bargain was struck, and the story ends. The dog led the man round and round, and they came to safety. I was speaking at the Hebrew Academy in San Francisco a couple of years ago, and I was speaking to a group of sixth graders, and it occurred to me that I might tell them some of the old Kiowa stories, and I thought of that one, and I said, yes, this story will surely appeal to a room full of sixth graders. And so I started the story. I said, this happened a long time ago when dogs could talk. And a little girl in the front row looked up at me and she said, those were the days. Completely ruined the story, of course. I often think of her with great malice. I think that when she grows up, if she's allowed to grow up, she will become an actress, you know, a great scene stealer. I have that wonderful thing, a work in progress. It's like a credit card, a work in progress. You can go great distances on the strength of a work in progress. Did you know that? It's wonderful. I may never finish it. It is called Set. It's a novel which bears the working title, Set. But I have grown so fond of that title, which means bear in Kiowa, that I think it. I will keep it. And it will indeed be the title of the novel. I want to read you what is the prologue to Set. First, I have to tell you a story. There is a place in Wyoming called Devil's Tower. I'm sure that some of you have been there. It's just across the line from South Dakota, and it's in the Black Hills. It is a formation that has to be seen to be believed. It has the conformation of a tree stump, and it rises out of the great pine forests of the Black Hills like the end of the world. It rises, if I remember rightly, only about 900 feet from base to summit. It rises 1,200 feet above the Belle Fourche River, which runs at its base. Well, as I mentioned to you, the Kiowas once lived in the Black Hills, and they have a story about this monolith, which they call Tsowai, which means in Kiowa, rock tree. It's a much better name than Devil's Tower. The story goes like this. There were eight children there at play, seven sisters and their brother. The boy was pretending to be a bear, and he was running after his sisters. The little girls were pretending to be afraid, and they were running. Well, in the course of this game, a terrible thing happened. The boy actually turned into a bear. And when the little girls saw this, they were truly terrified, and they ran for their lives, and the bear after them. And as they were running as hard as they could through the Black Hills, the forest there, they passed the stump of a tree, huge tree stump, and the tree spoke to them and said, if you will climb upon me, I will save you. And the little girls scampered on top of the tree stump, and as they did so, it began to rise into the air. The bear came to kill them, but they were beyond its reach, and it reared up against the stump of the tree and scored the bark all around. And the story ends simply, the seven sisters were born into the sky, and they became the stars of the Big Dipper. It's a wonderful story to me. for a number of reasons, not the least of which is that when I was an infant, when I was about 6 months old, my parents took me from Oklahoma, where we were then living with my grandmother, to Devil's Tower, Wyoming. And when we returned, I guess we stayed there a week or so, when we returned, an old man of the tribe, whose name was Paul Haw, came to visit. And we were all out in the arbor. It was in August, as I recall, or as I have been told. I don't really remember it. And we were, the family was convened, and the old man came and took me in his arms, and he performed, in effect, the name-giving ceremony. He told stories. He talked for a long time until all the other voices in the arbor fell away, and there remained only his. And he talked about the coming out people, which the Kiowas call themselves, having come out of the log. He talked about all of the good things and all of the bad things that had happened to them in time. And then at the end, he looked down at me and he said, "And now you are Tsowai Tali." That's my Indian name, and it means rock tree boy, to commemorate my having been taken to this very special and sacred place in Kiowa tradition. Just about a year ago, by the way, I camped on the east side of Tsowai under a full moon, and I watched it. I watched it as darkness came upon it, and the light of the moon took over, and I saw it change in color, depth, conformation. And as I stood there, enchanted, just watching it, I don't know how long, the stars of the Big Dipper appeared immediately above it, and I watched them until they rode over to the north of it. The boy ran after his sisters. There was a bursting of the boy's heart. He stumbled and gasped and stood still. The cries of his sister pierced his brain like a madness. He caught his breath, or not his own breath, really, but the breath of something other and irresistible and wild. The ground was almost cold. Dust floated in the slanting rays of the sun. Somewhere a raven called, and when the boy looked up, his sisters, too, were standing still, off among the trees, and their faces were drawn and terrible with fright. In their eyes was certain love and longing, and they began to run again, and again he took up the chase. Akide. That summer, the light was hard and brilliant, and the meadows were high with grass, and the grass was thick with wild flowers, blue columbine and lupin and paintbrush. The sky was very deep, and the mountain seemed to sound its depth. The days were warm, and the mornings and evenings cool. Two of the people died, but they were old and through with their lives. A child was born. There was no sickness to speak of, and nearly everyone got on well without anger or sorrow. The rivers and streams were swift and cold. The hunting was good. Children invented games. The women talked incessantly, and their voices were excited and high-pitched, and their words ran into laughter again and again. The men talked too, mostly of hunting, but sometimes they teased the women and boasted of how handsome they all were, both men and women. "We are indeed a handsome people," they said, and laughed. The men greased their hair and dressed themselves in fine skins and beautiful feathers, and all the trade goods they could lay their hands on, quill work, bits of bone and shell, talons and teeth. The dogs slept and grew fat. Now and then a man or a woman, or even a child if it were old enough to be careful, would walk away from the camp and turn around in the distance just to look back, full of pride and admiration. The camp was big and alive, set out like a scattering of great white stones in the green rolling plain against the dark timbered hills. The teepees were tall and luminous. Vines of smoke crept up from the cooking fires. Sometimes the smoke was blue, sometimes gray or violet. There was always the smell of meat roasting. And the camp was full of sound. There was much dancing, and the voices of the singers and the beating of the drums carried everywhere. Then, one day, there was a quickening of the blood and a falling off of the laughter and the singing and the drums. And in that lapse and hush, the people let the summer go, thoughtful that the earth was going on from season to season, bearing them to a destiny. From the opening of her teepee, from the highest point in the camp, the old woman, Koi Aim Toya, saw the children moving across the wrinkles of the meadow towards the trees. Zedelbe, she thought, a bad business, dangerous. It was well past noon, and the light had begun to deepen. There were golden glints in the air and a faint haze on the woods. Koi Aim Toya squinted and blinked her eyes, trying to see who the children were, but they were too far away, moving away, their backs to the camp. She counted them, 5, 6, 7. Then she counted them again. There were 8. Where did they think they were going? Were they being sent out to forage? That wasn't likely. All the racks in the camp were hung with meat. No one was hungry. The children bobbed and skipped and tumbled away in the distance. Oh, they were only at play, she decided, running around, wasting their time, giving not a thought to their safety. She clicked her tongue and set a mask upon her face, a perfect scowl. And in the very way of an old woman, she wondered aloud what was to become of the people they had grown so careless. She scolded the children, but she could no longer see them. They had already entered into the trees, into the darkness that seemed to Koi Aim Toya absolute. Zedelbe. Well, someone has to worry, she sighed. If no one should worry, what then? The notion made her shudder. A hawk sailed past the sun, its shadow slithering in the grass. No one ever saw the sisters again. Only on the day they left the camp did anyone speak their names. Their names were soon forgotten, though the sisters themselves were remembered, not as individual children with particular appearances and manners, but collectively. They had become the little sisters to whom it happened. For the first few days and weeks after the children disappeared, the people of the camp gathered themselves up in the dusk and waited for the stars to come out. And when the stars did come out, the people were full of wonder and a kind of loneliness. Some of them made exclamations, but most of them remained silent and entirely respectful, reverent even. In the hold of such events, there is little to be said. Then a great storm descended upon the hills, and the sky roiled for 4 days and 4 nights, and there were no stars to be seen. After that, the people did not convene in the same way for the same purpose. They went on with their lives as if nothing had happened. Even the parents of the lost children went on as if nothing had happened. Of course, there was the question at first of whether or not they ought to grieve. They decided that they ought not, and no one blamed them. Only old Coy Aimtoyer, one late morning when the snow swirled and there was a general silence in the camp, emitted a series of sharp tremolo cries and cut off two fingers on her left hand. The boy was seen. One by one, hunters returned from the woods with stories in which a bear figured more or less prominently. Sometimes the bear was said to run on its hind legs. Sometimes it was said to approach the hunter gladly, with goodwill, as if it had no sense of danger whatsoever. One hunter, a man with a withered neck, was so enchanted by the bear's behavior that he could do nothing but stand with his arms at his sides. The bear came upon him, breathed the scent of camas upon him, lay its great flat head to the hunter's genitals. In a strange moment in which there was no fear on either side, there was recognition on both sides, the hunter said. The bear cried in a human voice. Then, too, a pagan woman named Tabsan, who had been captured by the Kiowas, told the following story. One night, there appeared a boy in the pagan camp. No one had ever seen it before. It was not bad-looking, and it spoke a language that was pleasant to hear, though none could understand it. The wonderful thing was that the child was perfectly unafraid, as if it were at home among its own people. The child got on well enough, but the next morning it was gone, as suddenly as it had appeared. Everyone was troubled. But then it came to be understood that the child never was, and everyone felt better. After all, said an old man, how can we believe in the child? It gave us not one word of sense to hold on to. What we saw, if indeed we saw anything at all, must have been a dog from a neighboring camp or a bear that wandered down from the high country. Tsowai, the great stump of the tree, stood against the sky. There was nothing like it in the landscape. The tallest pines were insignificant beside it. Many hundreds of them together could not fill its shadow. In time, the stump turned to stone, and the wind sang at a high pitch as it ran across the deep grooves that were set there by the bear's claws long ago. Eagles came to high above it, having caught sight of it across the world. No one said so, but each man in his heart acknowledged Tsowai, and the first thing he did upon waking was to cast his eyes upon it. And always, Tsowai was there. It would be there forever. In time, it came to be a great consolation in itself and an object of profound belief. There were wars and other disasters, and it was determined that the people should leave that place. They journeyed southward into the wide, shimmering country. There the plain was so vast that it could not bear an ordinary place name. It was called, therefore, the Land of Innumerable Long Distances. Those who came after them, whatever people they were, found the round bare patches in the grass of the meadow, the charred wood of the fires, the bones of birds and beavers and deer and dogs and the tracks of a great bear. Koi Aimtoyas, great, great grandson, became a renowned maker of shields. He never saw Tsoai, but he knew Tsoai in himself, its definition in his mind's eye, its awful silence in the current of his blood. On his shields were the most powerful medicines of all: bear claws, eagle wings, human hair, and the likenesses of stars. In his old age, he dreamed of things that happened before his time. The whole history of the people was played out in the mirror across the plane of his dreaming. And the last of his dreams was that of children moving to a wall of woods. They bobbed and skipped and tumbled away in the distance. He watched them for a time, and then he could no longer see them. They had already entered into the trees, into the darkness.
Thank you very much. I would like to say to you that I would like to invite you to come up and have a cup of coffee and a sweet up on the balcony area right here in the building, and chat with our artists if you would like to. Thank you. Good night.